That's another clip from the Yes Men Are Revolting, but actually a scene of a real-life launch. Andy Bicklebaum.
Yeah.
What are the survivor balls?
Well, the survivor balls are these props, basically, to open the film. But the film is really ultimately about Occupy. And the reason you see us getting depressed and losing hope and so on is so that we can come out and get hope once we see Occupy, where a lot of people would come up and tell us they had gotten their start in activism by seeing one of our movies. So all of the things that we thought didn't work or didn't matter or didn't have an impact ultimately did through the bigger movement they were a part of. And that's the message of our film, that you've got to be a part of a bigger movement. And that's where impact happens. They all win.
And I want to thank you for being with us, Andy Bicklebaum and Mike Bonanno, members of the Yes Men. The Yes Men Are Revolting is the name of the film. This is Democracy Now!, and we have two job openings, a senior news producer and an engagement editor. Find out more at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Renee Feltz, Nermeen Sheikh, Steve Martinez, Sam Alkoff, Honey Masood, Ravi Karan, Dina Guzder, Amy Littlefield, Anna Uzbek. I'm Amy Goodman with Aaron Maté, our website, democracynow.org.
You are listening to KBOO Portland. The time is 5 o'clock. Coming up next is the KBOO Evening News.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to be the sponsor of the 28th Annual Waterfront Blues Festival, taking place from July 2nd through the 5th at Waterfront Park in Portland. The Blues Festival includes cruises like the Blue Bayou Cruise, the Rock the Boat Dance Cruise, Drifting Blues Cruise, and the Sail On Sister Cruise, as well as after-hour performances featuring Galactic, Charmaine Neville, Big Bad Voodoo Daddy, and the Paladins. Again, that's the 28th Annual Waterfront Blues Festival, Thursday, July 2nd through Sunday, July 5th at the Waterfront Park in Portland. For more information, go to kboo.fm/waterfrontbluesfestival2015.
Attention KBOO members and listeners. The KBOO Foundation is seeking to fill 4 upcoming vacancies on the Board of Directors. Terms run 3 years, beginning on October 1st. The nomination packet, due July 11th, is posted on the KBOO website and paper copies are available at the station. Candidates must submit the completed nomination packet via email to kboocommunity@gmail.com or mail or drop off the completed nomination packet, care of Timothy Welp, 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, 97214. Incomplete forms will not be considered as fulfilling the statement of interest requirement by the KBOO bylaws. Packets are due by Saturday, July 11th. The candidate statements submitted as part of the nomination packet will be posted to KBOO's website, and candidates will be expected to participate in an interview for broadcast and a Q&A session at the annual meeting. For more information, please contact the nominating committee at kboocommunity@gmail.com.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, the House is keeping the Trans-Pacific Trade Pact alive by postponing a vote on part of the trade package.
Oregon House Speaker Tina Kotek is introducing a bill to raise the minimum wage to $13 an hour.
And the Portland Police Association is asking the city to hire more officers.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, June 16th, 2015. I'm Jared Dantzler.
And I'm Nicole Weinstock. The fight for a higher minimum wage in Oregon continues on two fronts. In Salem, Speaker of the House Tina Kotek is introducing a bill to raise the minimum wage to $13 an hour. And tomorrow, 15 Now PDX is sponsoring a rally at City Hall. For more detail on this issue, KBOO's Jim Thompson spoke with Justin Norton Kirsten.
Justin, what is new with the fight for 15?
Oh, well, there's a lot going on. People may know, the House Speaker Tina Kotek is introducing a new bill this week. We've got a big event coming up tomorrow here in Portland. There's a lot going on.
Well, hey, let's start with Tina Kotek. I understand that she's actually pushing for 13.
Right, yeah. So she's, I believe there'll be a couple hearings that will include discussion of her proposal, which is, yes, with $13 statewide minimum wage, and then also lifting the preemption law that prevents cities from raising minimum wage.
What is the current Oregon wage, minimum wage?
It's $9.25 per hour right now.
Well, 13 would be a substantial boost.
It would be a substantial boost, yeah. I mean, it would be a good, you know, $4 an hour raise. And, you know, working people in Oregon definitely need a raise. We stand firmly behind the idea that $15 is really what working people in Oregon need in order to be able to, you know, pay the bills and feed their families without relying on public assistance. You know, and the minimum wage, let alone, you know, wages of people who have more experience on the job, and aren't making minimum wage. You know, all wages have been stagnant for too long.
In her proposal at 13, I just wondered how you feel about it. Is it? It seems like quite a compromise. It's a step in the right direction.
I would definitely say it would be a step in the right direction. It's not insignificant. It's certainly better than 11 or 12. Like Tina Kotek said, it puts a family of four above the federal poverty level. The problem with that is that the federal poverty level doesn't include a lot of things that have really become kind of staple costs for families, child care, for example. Back in the 60s, when the federal poverty level was set, child care wasn't something that was a major cost for most families, but that's changed a lot over the decades.
And other things go up, like rents, food.
Right, and health care, which is a mandate now, and rent is going rising at out of control prices, not just in Portland, but you know, all over Oregon.
So let me ask you about the preemption law.
That's actually a law that was pushed by the Restaurant Association back in the early 2000s, and it's a worker law that ALEC actually has model legislation that they have on their website that they call a living wage preemption mandate that they're trying to push on states to make sure that cities can't raise their minimum wages. And it really ignores the fact that there are more expensive places to live than others.
How does that preemption law work in practice?
Right. So basically what it does is it prevents any local municipality or government other than the state from raising the minimum wage. And there are a couple exceptions, like employees of the city or the county, or employees that work for companies that contract with a city or a county.
Part of Tina's bill would eliminate that.
Right, yeah. So then it would essentially make it so a city like Portland or Eugene or even, like Lincoln City or Hood River, other places where, and even maybe $15 an hour isn't enough. So those cities would be able to take action on their own and raise the wage to a level that is appropriate for working people in that area. We would be really excited if that preemption law got repealed.
Well, let me change the subject a little bit. What's going on tomorrow? I understand that there's some action.
We're going to meet at City Hall at 11:30. We're going to be pushing for a $15 minimum wage for all the seasonal and part-time parks and recreation workers that were left out of the $15 fair wage policy that the city passed this past spring. And then from there, we're going to head over and support a group of janitors that are fighting for 15 and for union rights in downtown Portland.
Say again the time?
Yeah, well, we're meeting at 11:30 at City Hall is when the rally will start.
Okay, 11:30 at City Hall. I repeat the question just to make sure everybody caught it.
Yeah, we hope everybody can come out.
Very good. Anything else you want to add?
Just that we're really, really working on the $15 minimum wage for not only the whole state. We need everybody to get involved and come out and really help us put pressure and make sure that we can win.
Okay, Justin, thanks very much for this conversation. And for KBOO News.
Yeah, thank you.
KBOO News, I'm Jim Thompson.
The House of Representatives today postponed a vote on the Trade Adjustment Assistance Bill, or TAA. They had rejected that measure last week and were expected to reconsider it today. The TAA is part of a package that has already been approved by the Senate, and it needed to pass in order to advance the Trans-Pacific Partnership deal. KBOO reporter Doug McVeigh spoke with Margaret Flowers of Popular Resistance and the Stop Fast Track Coalition to find out more.
The House today was supposed to reconsider the TAA, but Speaker John Boehner decided to postpone that vote until the end of July. I'm speaking with Dr. Margaret Flowers from Popular Resistance, which is part of the Stop Fast Track Coalition. Margaret, what exactly is going on back there in D.C.?
That's a great question. I don't think that anybody really knows quite right now. The fact that they didn't pass trade adjustment assistance last Friday puts kind of the whole thing on hold, and they were supposed to vote on it within, 48 hours with the motion to reconsider, but now they voted to, they can actually vote on it any time between now and the end of July. And what the big confusion is whether the Speaker has to give warning if there's a vote or if he can just bring it up anytime he wants to. So I think there's confusion about that, and there's confusion about the best way to move forward, but they're trying to figure it out right now.
I've seen some rumors in media that they may be considering a trade-off, buying support for the trade bills by offering to move transportation and highway funding through. Do you think something like that could fly, or have you heard anything about that?
Well, that was what former Speaker Pelosi was saying over the weekend, that she would be more willing to smooth the way for the trade bills if she could get $100 billion in highway funding. I don't know if the Speaker Boehner is going to be willing to work with her on that. He's saying that he feels kind of betrayed because she voted against TPA and TAA. We're also hearing that it's interesting. President Obama is now working closely with Senator Mitch McConnell and Speaker Boehner to try to move things forward instead of anybody in his own party. And they're talking about possibly separating the bills in the Senate so they can just pass the fast-track bill and try to move that one without trade adjustment assistance. So I don't know if that's really got any legs. I think they're just really scrambling right now to figure out how to do this.
Congress is due to go into recess shortly. They're scheduled to go back to work after the July 4th holiday. What can people, our listeners, among others, do in the meantime?
Well, I think it's really important to keep the pressure on. And, of course, that's hard to do as things drag out. We had such a fantastic response in the last couple of weeks of tens of thousands of phone calls every day coming into Congress overwhelmingly against fast track. And so I think particularly in Oregon, you have some work to do because three of your Congress members, Kurt Schrader, Earl Blumenauer, and Susan Bonamici, all voted for the fast track bill. I had a couple of encounters with Congressman Blumenauer today, and it was pretty clear from my conversations with him that he is not really up to speed on what is in the Trans-Pacific Partnership or why fast track is important. He didn't understand that it would raise healthcare costs and lower access to healthcare. He didn't understand that the Trans-Pacific Partnership is almost completed in its negotiations. Either he doesn't understand that or he's not willing to admit that he knows that. But I think that it's up to Oregon voters to really push on these three and let them know that there will be political consequences if they continue to support fast track. I think one thing that we're hearing is in the media is that they think that we've won, that we've got a victory, that fast track is dead. We're not quite certain of that yet. I think that we're close, and that if people can continue to be vigilant through July, then if we can hold off a vote during that time, I think that we'll be in good shape for the rest of Obama's presidency, and perhaps the next president may not even be willing to pick it up again. So I think it's been a long fight. We've seen a tremendous movements come together. We've seen a grassroots that's ready to mobilize quickly and fight this. I'm just urging the listeners to hang in there for another month and let's really get this done.
Terrific. I've been speaking with Dr. Margaret Flowers from Popular Resistance and the Stop Fast Track Coalition. Reporting for KBOO News, this is Doug McVeigh.
A bill to revise both the Oregon Medical Marijuana Act and the Legal Adult Use Marijuana Law is on its way to the floors of both the State House and Senate. Last night, the Joint Committee on Implementation of Measure 91 unanimously approved House Bill 3400 with a do-pass recommendation. The bill contains some contentious provisions. Most notably, it would allow cities and counties to enact a ban on medical dispensaries, retail outlets, and other marijuana businesses by a vote of local government. Measure 91 originally only allowed bans to be enacted by a city or countywide initiative measure. Municipalities had been allowed to enact temporary moratoriums on medical marijuana outlets after dispensaries were first approved. The committee is still considering another bill to change the tax structure for retail marijuana. Taxes were originally a set dollar amount per ounce applied at the production level and paid by growers. The new proposal, HB 2041, changes that to a sales tax of up to 17%, with cities and counties getting the option of adding an additional sales tax of up to 3%.
States which have legalized medical cannabis have not seen an increase in marijuana use by young people. That's the conclusion of new research published in the journal Lancet Psychiatry. Researchers at the Mailman Institute, School of Public Health at Columbia University, examined data on marijuana use by young people gathered through the University of Michigan's Monitoring the Future survey project. They looked at responses from over 1 million young people surveyed in between 1991 and 2014. The study's authors concluded that passage of state medical marijuana laws does not increase adolescent use of marijuana. These results held true even the authors redefined marijuana use as any use in the previous year when they controlled for frequency of use and when they reanalyzed the laws for delayed effects and for variation in provisions and dispensaries. The researchers also found that although states which have legalized medical cannabis had higher rates of use by youth than those that did not, the risk of use before passing medical marijuana laws did not differ significantly from the risk after the laws were passed. Full text copies of the study titled Medical Marijuana Laws and Adolescent Marijuana Use in the USA from 1991 to 2014, results from annual repeated cross-section surveys, are available for free from the Lancet Psychiatry website.
The Federal Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration reported last week that binge drinking among underage people in the U.S. has dropped over the last decade. Nearly 23% of young people in the U.S. between 12 and 20 years of age are past or current alcohol users, according to the most recent survey data. Just over 14% of them are current binge drinkers. Binge drinking is defined as having five or more drinks on the same occasion, that is, at the same time or within a couple of hours of each other, on at least one day in the preceding 30 days. These alcohol use numbers are strikingly high, yet they show a steady improvement over the last decade. Underage alcohol use in general peaked in 2003, when an estimated 29% of those between 12 and 20 were current alcohol users. Binge drinking, meanwhile, hit its peak in 2004, when an estimated 19.6% of those between 12 and 20 had been binge drinking in the previous month. Alcohol is the most widely used drug among 12 to 20-year-olds in the U.S. SAMHSA reports that for that age group currently, about 17% are past month tobacco users, while only 13.6% used illicit drugs in the past month.
The president of the Portland Police Association is asking the mayor to hire at least 100 officers over the next 18 months. Officer and President Daryl Turner said the city's force is currently dangerously understaffed and overworked. Turner says that every precinct is asking officers to work overtime in order to meet their minimum staffing requirements. A survey by the Federal Bureau of Justice Statistics last month showed that the Portland Police Bureau has fewer officers per city resident than most other cities of similar size. The study also showed that the Bureau had fewer minority officers. Consultants hired by the city in April to study staffing issues in the police department raised concerns about the amount of vacation and leave time that is taken by Portland police officers. In 2013, Portland police officers averaged about 25 to 50 more hours of leave than other law enforcement agencies. Portland police remain under scrutiny from the U.S. Justice Department for unlawful and excessive use of force against people with mental health issues.
Two men escaped from a work crew in Clark County, Washington this afternoon. The two men were identified as Randall Marlowe and Donald McLean. They were working on a landscaping project in a rural area southeast of Battleground when they managed to escape into the woods. Marlowe is serving a sentence for property assault, and McLean had charges of theft and drug violations. Unlike the escape of two inmates from a prison in New York State last week, there has been no call for a multi-agency manhunt to find the two men. But police say they are asking people in the area to stay alert and keep an eye out for the two escaped prisoners. They were imprisoned at the Larch Correction Center in Yakult and were among a group of prisoners working for no pay on work crews on public land.
And now we turn to the weekly commentary from Paul Cienfuegos for Community Rights and Dismantling Corporate Rule, produced weekly for the Tuesday Evening News.
Greetings, you're listening to the weekly commentary by yours truly, Paul Cienfuegos. This week I'm going to do something quite different than what I usually do in my weekly commentaries. I've invited my colleague and friend Lawrence Cole from Port Townsend, Washington, to share some thoughts and a song with you. Lawrence is one of the most extraordinary song leaders in the Pacific Northwest, and I've had the honor to co-teach with him in both Iowa and here in Portland, Oregon. Lawrence, I know that you think and feel a lot about the state of our world today, about the corporate rule crisis that keeps on growing in all of our communities, and also about the healthier and more peaceful world that you yearn to co-create with others. I'd love it if you would share some of those thoughts and feelings.
Well, for quite a long time in my life, and I'm a bit over 70 now, and for as long as I've been conscious, I have been aware that the earth is in trouble. And ultimately, some probably 30 years ago, or I don't know when, just began to realize there is an amorality in the corporate world, in the corporate imperative, whatever it is that drives the corporate sensibility to be growing profit on a quarterly basis tends to impose a quality of not caring. You cannot care about what gets in the way of profit. And there's only one way to keep growing profit, which seems to be necessary in an economy where money is created by making more debt. So there's always more debt than there is money, and so there always has to be a growing of money through creating more debt. And anyway, it just seemed like such a morass of this carelessness impacting the living world and the natural world in such a way that I just hungered for finding anyone, someone, who could begin to address this issue, which seems to entrap our entire culture in what some people call a suicidal economy that's actually literally depleting the life support systems of the planet and messing with the climate in such a way that we may not have a living planet in not a very long time. Something's got to be done, and I run into Paul Cienfuegos. And he's doing something, and he's had some success, and he's awakening people to a way to begin to work with this process of taking the power back to the people. And to me, community rights is not about just the people. It's about the rights of all nature, and it's about recognizing that without a thriving world, human culture and human economy is doomed. And so it's not about regulating how much poison goes into the water and the air. It's beginning to wake up to know we have a responsibility to all other creatures to make sure that everything that lives has clean air, pure water, good, rich, living soil. So I wrote a song about it, and it goes like this. It's a declaration, and it's usually done in call and response. And maybe I'll have Paul sing along, and all he can even pretend he knows a harmony, and we'll see what happens there. And or I'll sing a harmony, and he can sing the melody I sing to him. But it goes like this: We are here.
We are here
to declare.
To declare
the living rights of all nature, the living rights of all nature, the right to clean air, the right to clean air, the right to pure water,
the right to pure water,
the right to rich living soil,
the right to rich living soil,
for all peoples,
for all peoples,
for all creatures,
for all creatures,
for all living things,
for all living things,
in this whole living world. It's a little raggedy, but you get the idea. It's just, let's just take a stand for the living world and for what matters to every living thing.
Lawrence, that was scrumptious. Thank you so much. Thank you for joining me today. If folks want to learn more about Lawrence's work, they can go to lawrencecole.com. You've been listening to the weekly commentary by yours truly, Paul Cienfuegos. You can hear future commentaries every Tuesday on the KABU Evening News in Portland, Oregon, and on a growing number of other radio stations. I welcome your feedback. You can subscribe to my weekly podcast via iTunes or at communityrightspdx.org. You can follow me on Twitter at @CienfuegosPaul. You can sign up for my newsletter at paulcienfuegos.com. Thanks for listening, and remember, we are the people we've been waiting for.
You are listening to the KABU Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an interview with an activist from Brazil about a Brazilian-Palestinian activist on a hunger strike, followed by KABU's new show Preferences, hosted by Alan Silver, on at 6. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather will be mostly cloudy, then gradually becoming sunny with a high near 74. And today in history, in 455, Rome was sacked by the Vandals. And in 1976, a group of South African high school students led a protest that would become known as the Soweto Uprising. June 16th is now a public holiday, Youth Day, in South Africa. The quote of the day is from Steve Biko: "The most potent weapon in the hands of the oppressor is the mind of the oppressed."
It's 5:27 p.m., time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
One reason corporations get away with running roughshod over us is that America's mass market media has been thoroughly corporatized, both in structure and mindset. So our daily news feed is largely a regurgitation of the corporate line. This corporate media symbiosis can be seen in an upcoming food conference for journalists put on by the National Press Foundation. NPF bills its meeting as an in-depth, all-day, all-expenses-paid boot camp for reporters on the issues of feeding the world's growing population. Sounds great. Educating reporters is a plus. But wait, shouldn't journalists ask, who's providing this education? Corporations, that's who. NPF is funded by such giants as Bayer, Entergy, Ford, Honda, Lockheed Martin, and Prudential, as well as by corporate foundations, lobbyists, and PR firms. And who is the chief sponsor of NPF's boot camp on the future of food? Monsanto. In fact, NPF moved the conference to St. Louis, home of this notorious huckster of genetically altered frankenfoods, specifically so reporters could come visit its corporate labs and get educated. Ask about Monsanto's bad reputation, NPF chief Sandy Johnson turned oddly defensive. In whose eyes? In your eyes? She snapped at the reporter. before asserting that Monsanto's GMO manipulations, quote, allowed the United States to feed the world. That's a line straight out of Monsanto's propaganda, not exactly the stuff of real journalism. Indeed, what's going on in the St. Louis boot camp is symbiosis in action. One, the corporation funds the corporate foundation, which two, puts a veneer of journalistic legitimacy on a conference that three, promotes what the corporation is selling. This is Jim Hightower saying, much of today's reporting seems unreal because it's not real, and not journalism. It's spoon-fed corporate indoctrination.
What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
A federal judge gave a mixed ruling on a case brought by the former CEO of the banking insurance firm AIG on Monday. The ruling essentially said that the government was too hard on AIG in the terms of its bailout after the 2008 financial crisis. The judge also criticized the actions of a law firm called Davis Polk, which represented the federal government during the bailout negotiations. AIG received over $185 billion in bailout funds from the federal government following the financial crisis of 2008. The former CEO, Maurice Greenberg, brought the lawsuit against the government because he said the feds were too hard on AIG. In a 75-page ruling issued Monday, federal judge Thomas Wheeler essentially agreed with that assertion, but offered no further financial compensation beyond the $185 billion that AIG already received.
H.R. 1599, proposed by Kansas Republican Congressman Mike Pompeo, has been greatly expanded to prohibit all labeling of genetically engineered foods, as well as make it unlawful for states or local governments to restrict GE crops in any way. H.R. 1599, titled the Safe and Accurate Food Labeling Act of 2015, is a reintroduction of Pompeo's previous Monsanto Protection Act, H.R. 4432, also known as the DARK Act, for deny Americans the right to know what is in our food. In this version of the bill, states are prohibited from passing new laws, and it will require previously passed state laws to be nullified. In the past 2 years, over 30 states have introduced laws requiring the labeling of GE foods. Recently in Oregon, a court upheld a Jackson County, Oregon law establishing a GE-free zone. This and numerous other state and county ordinances would be voided by the new bill. Colin O'Neill, Director of Government Affairs at the Center for Food and Safety, said, Monsanto and the biotech industry are the ones steering this ship. The bill draft will be discussed at a House hearing on Thursday. You can call or write your U.S. representatives and voice your opinion about this bill, H.R. 1599.
The FDA on Tuesday ruled that trans fat is not, quote, generally recognized as safe, unquote, for use in human food. The department gave food manufacturers 3 years to remove the partially hydrogenated oils, or PHOs, from their products. In 2013, the FDA had made a tentative determination that trans fats were no longer safe. After years of public comment and scientific review, this is the final step in the process. Manufacturers have had to list trans fat content on their labels since 2006, and there has been a significant decrease in the amount of trans fat in American foods. Dr. Stephen Nissen, the chair of cardiovascular medicine at the Cleveland Clinic, said, in the 1950s and 60s, we mistakenly told Americans that butter and eggs were bad for them and pushed people to margarine, which is basically a trans fat. What we've learned now is that saturated fat is relatively neutral. It is the trans fat that is really harmful, and we had made the dietary situations worse. Eating a diet rich in trans fat is linked to higher body weight, heart disease, and memory loss.
Pope Francis is expected to issue an encyclical on Thursday calling for greater global action on climate change, calling it a man-made crisis, and calling on all people, not only Catholics, to act to stop global warming. A draft of the Pope's 176-page encyclical was leaked yesterday by the Italian news weekly L'Espresso. Pope Francis is reportedly casting the effort to stop global warming as a moral issue. The encyclical reportedly calls on the public to enlighten the masters of power and money so that they should not fall prey to the sin of indifference, so that they should love the common good, support the weak, and care about this world that we inhabit. The Pope's statement is not being welcomed by everyone. At a campaign stop in New Hampshire, Republican presidential candidate Jeb Bush reportedly told supporters that religion ought to be about making us better as people and less about things that end up getting in the political realm. The papal encyclical will be officially issued this Thursday.
Last week, the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency released 1,000-plus draft pages of its hydraulic fracturing drinking water assessment. The report took 5 years to produce and essentially tells us what we already know. Fracking negatively impacts drinking water. The EPA also finally admitted that water resources have already been contaminated by fracking. The report states, "We found specific instances where one or more mechanisms led to impacts on drinking water resources, including contamination of drinking water wells." So much for past assertions that no instance of drinking water contamination has ever been documented. Of the 1,076 chemicals used in fracking that the EPA could identify, the agency was able to assess the chemical, physical, and toxicological properties for fewer than half. Of those, the majority have the potential to persist in the environment as long-term contaminants. Sierra Club's executive director, Michael Bruhn, said, "When you add up the threat to drinking water and all of the other problems with fracking that this report doesn't address, air pollution, climate-disrupting methane, landscape destruction, earthquakes, it's as obvious as ever that fracking is dirty, dangerous, and a terrible idea."
The environmental movement struggles daily to protect waterways, keep air clean, and ultimately stop the destruction of our planet. All over the globe, people are organizing. For example, in North Carolina, they work to mitigate pollution from industrial hog farms. In India, citizens fight to keep garbage from being tossed into the Yamuna River. And in China, organizers try to find solutions to stop coal pollution. All of these localized efforts are part of a larger global attempt to create sustainable environments. According to Robert F. Kennedy Jr., what they all have in common is their requirement for success, a fully functioning democracy. H2O Radio brings us this interview.
When we think about the environmental movement today, we might have preconceived notions it's about saving whales or protecting spotted owls or cleaning up polluted rivers.
What we don't expect to think about? Thomas Jefferson, the Constitution, fairness. But according to Robert F. Kennedy Jr., that's precisely where the conversation needs to go to have a sustainable future on the planet.
We met with the longtime environmental attorney and president of Waterkeeper Alliance at the organization's annual meeting in Boulder, Colorado, to talk about the environment, democracy, and why the two are indivisible.
The best measure of how a democracy functions is how it distributes the goods of the land, how it distributes the commons, those assets, the air, the water, the wildlife, the fisheries, the public lands, the aquifers, the beaches, the shorelines, the rivers, those assets that cannot be reduced to private property ownership, but by their nature are owned by the whole community. And the function of the government is to allocate, to make sure that everybody gets to use those resources. Nobody can use more than their share. Nobody can privatize those resources and turn them into private profit. Everybody, whether you're black or white, rich or poor, humble or noble, everybody should be able to go down to their local river, pull out a fish, and bring it home and feed it to their family. And the big battle that you see in a democracy is our efforts by powerful private entities within a society to privatize the public trust, to steal the air by polluting it, to steal the water and fisheries by dumping their waste into our rivers and streams. And what a democracy, one of the principal functions of democracy is to make sure that those assets stay in the hands of all of the public. And today, as you see huge concentrations and aggregations in the energy sector and the agricultural sector, which are the biggest polluting sectors, and in pharmaceutical, of course, you also see those same aggregations of power occurring in our political system. You know, one of the reasons Thomas Jefferson was fixated on keeping America an agricultural economy is because he thought that the only way to preserve democracy is if you had tens of thousands of yeoman farmers, each with a stake in our political process, who were also the backbone of the economy, that you would have a democracy that was fully functioning. In other words, he felt that we had to create a middle class at the major producers in the society had to be spread, had to be diverse, and they had to be spread across a large and pluralistic base. And, you know, democracy and human rights and civil rights and all the values that we cherish as a nation and that are embodied in our Constitution are tied up in the way that we allocate the resources of the environment.
Has the environmental justice movement always been important to Waterkeeper Alliance?
From the beginning. In fact, my first case for the Hudson Riverkeeper was a case in which the co-plaintiff was the NAACP, and it was a case involving the construction of a highway, the proposed construction of a highway on the Hudson River that would have been on pilings out of the river, and then it would have come to shore in a community in Ossining, New York, that was one of the oldest black communities north of the Mason-Dixon line. It was really an extraordinary community and a cohesive community, but it was picked to come ashore there because these were people who didn't have the political power. And, you know, throughout my career as an environmental attorney, I've found that story again and again. 4 out of every 5 toxic waste dumps in America is in a black neighborhood. You know, where does the landfill go, and where does the sewage treatment plant go, and where do we put these obnoxious facilities? Well, the fact is that we're putting them in the poorest neighborhoods, and we're putting them in the neighborhoods where people have no political power.
What do you view right now as the major upcoming issues as far as the Alliance is concerned and just at water in general?
Well, the primary issue is always intertwined with the way we use energy. You know, we find the agriculture and energy are two kind of big issues. And agriculture, we target primarily industrialization of agriculture and factory farming and meat. And then on the energy side, we target carbon. What we do essentially is we try to force the carbon incumbents to internalize the cost of their energy production, much of which lands in the water, whether it's mercury or acid rain or carbon. It's going to impact the waterways. It's going to aggravate global warming. It's going to aggravate the acidification of the ocean, the acidification of lakes and high altitude forests, and of course, mercury contamination. According to the National Academy of Sciences, there's now dangerous levels of mercury in every freshwater fish in America. We know about the mercury contamination in the saltwater species, but we're living in a science fiction nightmare today where my children and the children of most Americans can now no longer engage in the seminal primal activity of American youth, which is to go fishing with their father or mother in the local fishing hole and then come home and safely eat the fish. So it's been a continuing theme of of my career, and it's been one of the kind of founding tenets of Waterkeeper Alliance that protecting the environment is about protecting democracy, about protecting notions of justice and fairness and equality and human rights and civil rights, and all those things are wrapped up into one package.
We've been speaking with Robert F. Kennedy Jr., environmental attorney and president of Waterkeeper Alliance. To learn more about Waterkeeper Alliance, visit waterkeeper.org. To hear upcoming interviews with Waterkeeper members, visit our website at h2oradio.org.
Warming of the oceans could affect marine ecology more drastically than has been seen in some 3 million years. That's the conclusion of a study published earlier this month in the journal Nature Climate Change. Scientists from France, Monaco, and the United Kingdom were attempting to put climate change into historic perspective. The study highlights the changes in the Earth's biology that may lie ahead if climate change is not addressed. 70% of the world oceans could alter marine life dramatically, which would eventually affect humans. When the temperature rises, plant and animals move their habitat, which affects the world's ecosystem and alters the food web. The researchers concluded that severe warming that could have a greater effect on the oceans than has been seen in the planet's history since the last glacial maximum and the mid-Pliocene age.
And now the latest news and developments from the occupied territories in Palestine from the International Middle East Media Center in Bethlehem.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center at www.imemc.org for Tuesday, June 16th, 2015. A Palestinian youth injured by Israeli gunfire at the Gaza borders and in the West Bank, settlers destroy crops owned by local farmers. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. A Palestinian youth was shot and injured on Tuesday midday by Israeli troops near the Zikim military base at the Gaza borders with Israel. According to the Israeli sources, the youth climbed the outer fence of the military site. When troops ordered him to stop, the youth did not adhere to the soldiers' orders, who shot him in his leg. The youth was moved to an Israeli hospital where his wounds were described as moderate, Israeli sources added. Elsewhere, Israeli soldiers cut and uprooted on Tuesday morning hundreds of evergreens east of the central West Bank city of Tubas, Palestinian sources reported. The soldiers and personnel of the civil administration office run by the military in the occupied West Bank invaded a natural reserve accompanied by two bulldozers. According to the Palestinian sources, the destroyed area is over 300 dunams of land, which is 74 acres of land. In related news, a group of Israeli settlers late on Monday night and Tuesday at dawn burned wheat crops owned by farmers from Kufr al-Liblib village near Tul Karim in northern West Bank. The fire stretched over a vast area of Palestinian land and destroyed crops. Also on Tuesday at dawn, Israeli soldiers kidnapped five Palestinians in occupied West Bank, in addition to a woman and her son, while visiting her husband in the Eshel Israeli prison, and also kidnapped a physically challenged teen in Hebron. Moreover, Israeli police officers kidnapped on Tuesday two Palestinian women while leaving the Al-Aqsa Mosque in occupied Jerusalem and assaulted two elderly men. And that's all for today from the IMEMC News. This was the Tuesday, June 16th.